Blog Talk Radio.
In the desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. Want to thank you once again for taking time out of your busy life to join me on the radio broadcast this morning. Last night was an historic event in Southern California at the Reagan Library, where many Iranian Americans and others attended a very passionate speech by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, addressing the Iranian situation. I was thrilled to see this, and I had a chance to watch it live through Facebook and was just awestruck at the way that the Iranian-American audience reacted to the several things that Mike Pompeo had to say. Mike Pompeo talked about a host of many, many things. At one point, there was a distraction, someone yelling some anti-Trump rhetoric, and Mike Pompeo didn't miss a beat. As soon as that person was contained, he said, "How I wish Iranian people had that much freedom in their country to have an outburst like that without any consequences." And so Mike Pompeo is clearly aware of the oppression of the Iranian people. He pledged the support of the American people, the Trump administration, to the Iranian people in every facet of their suffering. And it was a historic event, and probably sometime later on this week, I will have some actual sound bites from the speech. I want to focus in on everything he had to say, but because of the late hour last night, I wasn't able to put it together for this morning's program. But again, many of my Iranian friends are celebrating this great event and very thankful to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and the Trump administration for standing up for the Iranian people. Much more will be said about this historic event this Thursday on the Cross in the Desert. I want to also continue on with a story I've been following for the last 2 years. It is the horrible situation for an American pastor in Turkey, Andrew Brunson, who is being held hostage on some trumped-up spy charges by the president of Turkey, which took place a couple of years ago. Remember when they had the military coup, a supposed military coup, and Erdogan put down the coup? Some charges that there was some people from that coup attending Pastor Brunson's church, and there is some kind of plot that Pastor Brunson is engaged in to overthrow the government of Turkey, which is absolutely, completely false. But I want you to hear right now a special report on the situation for Pastor Brunson right now on the cross in the desert.
It was the third hearing for the 50-year-old North Carolina pastor, and it ended in another disappointment.
That's because many people thought Andrew Brunson would be freed from prison. He has spent 20 months behind Turkish bars on accusations that he spied on the government and plotted with rebels to overthrow President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in July 2016.
For nearly 2 hours during the hearing, former church members testified against Pastor Brunson, making vague, unsubstantiated accusations. When the judge asked Brunson to reply to the witnesses, he said, quote, "My faith teaches me to forgive, so I forgive those who testified against me." Only one witness from the defense was allowed to testify. The U.S. government expressed concern about the court's decision.
I have read the indictment. I have attended three hearings. I don't believe that there is any indication that Pastor Brunson is guilty of any sort of criminal or terrorist activity.
The Trump administration and members of Congress have been pressuring Turkey to release the pastor. On Wednesday, President Trump expressed displeasure, tweeting, "A total disgrace that Turkey will not release respected U.S. pastor Andrew Brunson from prison. He's been held hostage far too long. Erdogan should do something to free this wonderful Christian husband and father. He has done nothing wrong, and his family needs him." Cece Heil of the American Center for Law and Justice says, immediately after the court decision, the Trump administration and members of Congress began working again diplomatically to help free Brunson.
It's a devastating blow. So I would just, you know, pray for encouragement for Pastor Brunson and for his family, because they suffer the same.
Gary Lane, CBN News.
Yes, this is a grave injustice. It's been more than 2 years since he's been held captive. And I want to make known to you that on my Facebook page, you can interact with his crisis captivity. There is, of course, a petition there for you to sign to be a voice for Pastor Brunson. It's on my Facebook page. I always have the current petitions there, so you can participate and do all that you can to be a voice for him. It is a really horrible situation, and it's a situation that President Trump has spoken out against. He has tweeted and really in many ways demanded that President Erdogan of Turkey release this good Christian man back to his family. And so we are doing everything we can here, praying for him and speaking out for him. But again, it's a very difficult situation. I believe in many ways that Pastor Brunson is being used like a political pawn. Speaking of situations of people in captivity, I want to go to a story that has been going on for approximately 4 years in Sweden. It's the story of Iranian refugee Aiden Stranson, and she is in danger of deportation back. The last I've checked, she is still there in Sweden. There has been no updated news. But her story is a unique story. It's the story of many Iranian refugees who somehow cannot make their case to the immigration board that their life is in danger and they need to stay there. The immigration board has done this so many times with Christians in Sweden, threatened to deport them back. CBN News has intervened. Petitions have been sent out. Pressure has been put on. And in some cases, I believe the immigration board is aware of the pressure being put on them. But I want you to sit back for the next few minutes and listen to this very important special report by CBN News on Aiden Stranson, Iranian refugee in Sweden in danger of being deported.
She is a woman without a country. Aiden Stranson is officially a stateless person. No passport, no citizenship, unable to get a job, and living every day with the knowledge she could be deported to her native Iran, where, as a Christian, she could face grave danger. A worldwide outcry over her situation has apparently not changed anything.
The world was outraged when the Swedish government decided to send a Christian and ex-Muslim back to Iran, where she could be imprisoned, raped, and even killed. But it didn't seem to bother the Swedish government at all.
After CBN News first brought the former Iranian actress's story to the world stage, the government of Hungary offered her asylum, and many people from around the world wrote the Swedish government asking it to reconsider.
It was really like a miracle for me when so many people in America, they called the Sweden embassy. Many people, they sent a comment to me and they said, you are welcome to our country.
But Sweden's migration board told CBN News none of that matters. Aydin's case has been turned over to the Swedish border police for deportation. Now she waits in a kind of legal limbo.
Aydin's situation is not at all unusual in Sweden. There are a fair amount of people who get stuck in between.
Swedish attorney Gabriel Donner knows Sweden's asylum process as well as anyone. He represented 160 Christian asylum seekers last year alone.
In your experience, should she expect to eventually be deported?
She is running that risk, quite obviously.
Aydin Stranson came to Sweden from Iran in 2014 on a work visa and adopted a Swedish last name. She left Islam and became a Christian in Iran after seeing a video of Muslims stoning a woman to death. And then she had a dream about Jesus. When she arrived in Sweden, she requested a public baptism.
I want to have it baptized in a public because I want to say I don't afraid anymore. I'm free, I'm Christian, I want everybody to know about that.
Which means the Islamic government of Iran knows. And because she starred in films and a TV series in Iran, it makes her an even bigger target if she is sent back. It's not clear if or when that might happen.
Well, when it comes to the border police, it all depends on whose table it lands on. Sweden's backlog is growing and growing and growing. Right now, it's around about 2 years and growing. This is contrary to European Union law, but nobody cares.
Donner says Aydin would first be sent to prison while authorities made arrangements to fly her to Iran.
This is real prison conditions. They're not allowed to speak in telephones. They're not allowed to be on a computer. They're not allowed to get in touch with anybody. They wear prison clothes. They wore, if they're transferred anywhere, they're transferred in chains.
Swedish authorities would then contact Iran and tell them Aydin is coming and when to expect her. Even though Sweden's migration board says on its own webpage it will never deport asylum seekers to nations where they face danger. Doing so is a violation of the Geneva Convention on Refugees. Sweden's migration board says it cannot comment on her case. Aydin spends her days helping at church or training in Taekwondo. She's earned a black belt, but the migration board took her certificate because she's not a legal resident. She thought she landed a job with the technology giant Ericsson as a computer programmer. But the Swedish government wouldn't allow that either. Sweden turned down Ericsson's plea to let her work for them.
So as soon as you get your negative, you cannot get any support of any sort, no housing, no place to work, and so on, even if you had a job before. The idea is to starve you to the point where you come to them and say, please send me out.
But she's staying in Sweden because her family is here and because she says Jesus told her not to be afraid. Stranson and other Christian asylum seekers in Sweden face deportation at the same time that the Swedish government has given 150 protected identities to former ISIS fighters who have returned to Sweden so that they can find jobs. There will be no such help for Aydin.
There have been fast lanes for Syrians, and there have been fast lanes for Somalis, but not for Iranians, and definitely not for Christians. We have even one judge here in Stockholm who never has said yes to any Christian.
If they're going to act on her case to deport her, she'll get a letter?
She doesn't necessarily get anything. They just turn up and can turn up any time.
I don't know what will happen for me in future, but I should say to them thank you, to people, to CBN, and to you, to all the people try to help me. I just can't say Jesus bless them all.
Dale Hurd, CBN News, Stockholm.
This is tremendously unfair. When you think about exactly what the narrator just said about Somalians giving preference, former ISIS fighters, protected identities getting jobs, this is a young actress who made her faith public by having a public baptism. And you know, of course, the Iranian government is quite aware of that. If she is deported back, she faces severe consequences because, according to Sharia law and according to what Muhammad taught, if anyone changes their religion, kill them, is a direct order against someone like an Aydin. Even if she wasn't a true Muslim in Iran, but a Muslim in name only, she's still considered Muslim by Islamic standards, and it would put her at serious, serious risk. And this is a beautiful, smart girl who is doing everything she can to try to find home there in Sweden. Let me just explain to you a couple of things. I have a dear friend, Manoush, who lives in Sweden. She also is a Christian. She works for human rights. She writes for my program. She has a lawyer there. The lawyer has access to all of the articles she's written for me. So he says her case is strong. Now, Manoush has a friend named Atna, whose case is not strong. She also is a Christian, but basically the information her friend is getting is that that's not enough. You must show and validate why you should not be deported back, how serious it is. But it seems like no matter what you say to the Swedish Immigration Board, they're going to find an excuse. Their excuse is we don't have enough room to take all of us in. And what they're really saying is they would prefer Somalians and Syrians compared to Iranians. This is really serious. It's unfair and unjust. And I just urge you to go to my Facebook page, scroll down, and find the petition for Aydin, and please sign it. It does make a difference in the long run. CBN has done a miraculous job in being her voice, and I want to join them and stand up for Iranian refugees like Aydin and, of course, my dear friend Manoush. She certainly needs your prayers, your thoughts, your voice as well. Christians have a difficult time in Sweden, and so they need us to stand behind them and be their voice. Speaking of voices, I want to transition here to the story I'm writing in my book, Broken Yet Beautiful, about the male guardianship law in Saudi Arabia. I've talked about this several times in my program before, and there is a massive campaign underway in Saudi Arabia to get the male guardianship law repealed. Even though women in Saudi Arabia are now legal and they can drive, the larger problem is not the driving. It is the male guardianship law. I want to share with you a very poignant blog written by a young, I guess you would call her a student and human rights activist. She says she is, her name is Thobika Felicia. She's 22 years old. She's studying criminology. She's a human rights peace activist, and she is currently working very hard on the Saudi Arabia campaign. Now, on my page, you'll see posts from time to time from a group organized, World Citizens for Saudi Women. They bring me the latest updates about what's going on there. And this young girl, she's only 22 years of age, decided that the women in Saudi Arabia needed a strong voice, someone with worldwide recognition to stand up for them. And she chose Oprah Winfrey. She has been following Oprah Winfrey all of her life. And so I want you to hear this blog that she wrote. It's entitled Why Oprah Rejected the Free Saudi Women Campaign. I want you to hear this. For those who might have not been aware, I am the creator of a campaign called, quote, the Free Saudi Women Campaign on change.org, which so far has gathered 21,000 supporters from around the world. I had never dreamt that something which I've created out of my own hands would receive so much support and attention from fellow activists around the world who share my concerns about the ignored atrocities taking place in Saudi Arabia. My journey into Middle Eastern advocacy has been one filled with unexpected, surprising, exciting, and depressing opportunities. It also became a big learning experience for me on the way. Within the campaign, I normally post regular updates about the victim cases that I'm working on, my online advocacy activities, developing projects, progression, as well as my connections with humanitarian organizations, governmental institutions, and celebrity influencers. One of my recent updates were in regards to the celebrity responses I had been receiving lately during the weeks I had been contacting their agents, from the likes of Trevor Noah, Oprah Winfrey, Naomi Campbell, Richard Branson, Bill Gates, Emma Watson, and many more. In my head, I had assumed that maybe, just maybe, the plan would work in my favor. Boy, was I wrong. I remember waking up in the early hours of the morning, checking my inbox as a daily routine. To my surprise, I had received an email response that came from Oprah Winfrey's agent. Bear in mind that I'm as nervous as heck because I didn't think I would ever receive a response in the first place. And two, it's Oprah's agent. I mean, it isn't every day that you get to be surrounded by what many would call Her Majesty. I opened the email and it read, quote, "Thank you for reaching out and for providing the surrounding information. We applaud the work you are doing for the Global Women's March organization and advocating against domestic abuse, false imprisonment, and the male guardianship system. It has been determined that Ms. Winfrey, unfortunately, will not be able to participate in the campaign, although we appreciate you wanting to include her voice in this. Best of luck with all of your efforts, and thank you again for all your hard work in helping the women of Saudi Arabia." Of course, I was devastated. I mean, it's not exactly the type of message I would like to wake up to in the early morning hours. Besides that, receiving a letter, a rejection letter, from a woman that I had praised since childhood, only to get a cold response over a matter that is considered worthy of influential support, is quite frustrating, especially when lives depend on it, literally. Anyways, after my little toddler-like tantrum that lasted for about a few minutes, I then had to remind myself that the rejection only stemmed from the fact that her relationship with the Saudi crowned prince mattered more than the women he is institutionally oppressing. I mean, think about it. When the prince had his world tour, United States became one of the countries he visited. It was more of a strategy to boost his country's image more than anything else. He shook hands with Bill Gates, Richard Branson, The Rock, and of course, Oprah Winfrey. I must say, the prince implemented a clever move, a move that now has the West kissing his feet and seeing him as the god of reform. In essence, money won and humanity lost. Besides, who did I think was to compete with an Arabic prince who has a net worth of $12 billion? Well, there you go. Money, power, prestige, all of that is more important than the lives of women. And Oprah Winfrey decided, after she had met the prince, she decided she wouldn't do something as offensive as being a voice for Saudi women. And she turned down this young activist's request. How very, very sad that money, reputation, and who you know is more influential than the lives of Saudi women. I want to take the time to read to you the story of the male guardianship law. This is from my new book that will be published, God willing, in the middle of next month, August. It's called Saudi Arabia and the Male Guardianship Law, Chapter 2. On Sunday, June 24th, 2018, the world witnessed an historic milestone take place in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. After decades of protests, the driving ban against women was finally lifted, and for the first time now, women can legally be issued driver's license and sit proudly behind the wheel of a car without going to jail again. While this is a major historic accomplishment in a nation hostile to the rights of women, still, it is a very long road ahead for women to finally experience true freedom. Most every Saudi woman will tell you that until the male guardianship law is finally repealed, that it will still be under the dominion of a man. Now, before explaining the restrictions on women because of the male guardianship law, I want to first educate you on a little of the history of Saudi Arabia and a form of Islam known as Wahhabism. Wahhabism was born through a radical 18th century Muslim reform movement. The purification of Islam took place through the efforts of Muhammad ibn al-Wahhab, was formally adopted by the Saudi family in 1744. Members of Wahhabism call themselves Unitarians with a strong emphasis on the absolute oneness of God, or Tawhid. They reject the practice of visiting tombs, venerating saints, advocating a return to the original teachings of Islam incorporated in both the Quran and Hadith. They also stress a literal belief in the Quran and the establishment of a Muslim state based solely on Sharia law. The Wahhabis occupied Mecca and Medina at the end of the 18th century, bringing everything under their control. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was created in 1932, assuring the religious and political dominance of Wahhabism. Many of the sites associated with the early history of Islam, that are the homes, graves, or companions of Muhammad, were demolished in order to purify the holy religion. Both Britain and the United States subsidized Saudi Arabia in 1945, right after World War II, and enabled them to join the United Nations. While the driving ban, as I mentioned, has been lifted, more than likely for economic reasons rather than women's rights, there is still a great chasm for females to cross until they have obtained equal rights. The rules for the male guardianship law still prohibit so much of women's freedoms, despite a few glimpses of hope on the horizon. In 2015, women were able to cast ballots for the first time during municipal elections, but couldn't speak to male voters or couldn't have men and women mixing in their campaign offices. The late King Abdullah issued a decree in 2011 that gave women the vote, and 2 years later ordered 20% of seats in the Consultative Council to be set aside for women. In 2015, there were more Saudi women studying in universities than men, and a few years earlier, in 2012, Saudi Arabia had sent two women to the Olympics. Well, there are some slight glimmers of hope. But let's get down to what restrictions are still on women under the male guardianship law. And it's entitled, What Saudi Women Cannot Do. Number one, Saudi women cannot divorce, travel, get a job, or have surgery, first without permission from their male guardians. Number two, Saudi women cannot mix freely with members of the opposite sex. In 2013, authorities ordered shops that employ both men and women to build separation walls to prevent sexes from commingling. Number three, Saudi women cannot appear in public without wearing a full-length black abaya, which is supposed to protect a woman's modesty in public. Number four, Saudi women cannot conduct certain businesses without a male sponsor. If a woman wants to have her own business, she has to call at least two men who can testify of her character in order to have a loan approved or a license. Number five, Saudi women cannot apply for a national identification card or passport. Number six, Saudi women cannot eat at restaurants that don't have a separated designated family section. Women are also required to use a separate entrance from men. Number seven, Saudi women cannot retain custody of their children in a divorce. Number eight, Saudi women cannot get a fair hearing in court. Surah chapter 2, verses 282 teaches that their testimony is only worth half that of a man's. And number nine, Saudi women cannot receive an equal inheritance. So much for the big decree for women to drive, which is really more for economic reasons than women's rights. When you hear the restrictions that are still on Saudi women, then you understand they have a long, long way to go. And that's one of the reasons why in my new book I want to talk about this, to educate us so that we can do something active to reach out to these women in prison in Saudi Arabia. Before I go to my song break, I want to read the latest story from my dear friend Manoush about Christian prisoners in Iran. During the last 40 years, the Islamic Republic has consistently shown violent behavior with those who leave Islam and convert to Christianity. In fact, Islam is a school of inhumane and reactionary, and all its laws and everything is mandatory in the framework of this religion: prayer, fasting, being Muslim, and being Muslim, wearing veils, and in short, everything is compulsory in Islam. Unfortunately, past months, there have been reports that the Iranian regime has attacked Christians' homes. In the wake of continued violations of the rights of religious minorities by the Islamic regime, 11 members of a house church in Isfahan were arrested by security guards and moved to an unknown location. According to eyewitnesses, the security guards armed, arrested, and detained people, along with a number of their belongings, books, pamphlets, and laptops. They were retrieved by them, put in a van, and they were moved to an unknown location. In recent years, especially after the leader of the Islamic regime and some Shiite authorities warned, the pressure on Christian heads in Iran has increased, and now dozens of nuns and Christian believers are in prison and detention centers, of course. It is also forbidden to publish and distribute the Bible in Persian, and Protestant churches are closed, and their church ceremonies are sometimes prevented. According to the reports, Christians, especially Protestants, and those who convert from Islam to Christianity and conduct religious rites are harassed, and harassed at various levels. One of the Christians who recently spent time in prison, his name is Saman. He is a convert from Islam to Christianity, was arrested in 2016 and imprisoned in Evin for 44 days because of activities related to his Christian faith. Saman says of his time in prison in Evin, "They tried to break me by telling me what a nobody I was. They broke my identity." He said he was afraid and felt hopeless, even beginning to doubt his faith. "I thought, is this it? Have I wasted 13 years of believing in God? Does he even exist?" He says they tortured him and they did everything they could to destroy his faith. Yes, in Iran, the only religion approved by the regime is Islam, and those who leave Islam are punished or executed. Because Islam is the religion of the forced religion, I should say, the religion of the sword, and punishment is prison and death. And this law has been implemented from the time of Muhammad to this day. Thank you, Manoush. You know exactly what you're talking about. And this is the danger, the grave danger for people like Manoush and like Adin and like Atna, who face the reality of deportation, what they would suffer if they went back to Iran. I want to take us now to a song break. This is new music from Hillsong. There Is More is the name of their new CD. This is a song of Who You Say I Am on the Cross in the Desert. Be back with you in 5 minutes.
Who am I that the highest King sees? Three.
It's great worship music from Hillsong of Australia. They were here at my church just a few months ago in April. I was unable to attend, but every time I hear that song, I'm just lifted in my spirits. I am chosen, not forsaken. I am who you say I am. It is a statement of who we are as children, sons and daughters of God. What a great song that is. This morning, we have talked about some very intense subjects from Pastor Brunson, his battle with the Turkish government for freedom. Adin Stranson, an Iranian refugee in Sweden, fighting a system to stay there instead of being deported. We've talked about the Saudi women, the plight for them, and how certain celebrities turn us down to not be our voice and to be a voice for them. And we've spoken just now about the oppressive nature of the male guardianship law, as well as the treatment of Christians in Iran. Governments, dictatorships treat us in inhumane ways. And it is a story I wrote a few years ago in my book, The Cross in the Desert, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran. This story sums up in so many words how people, human beings, are treated as inhumane objects for dictatorships to control. I want you to hear this story because it fits perfectly into exactly what I've been saying this morning. It's from my book, The Cross in the Desert. It's entitled Image is Everything, Right? I want you to hear this. One of the traditions of my Iranian friends as they prepare for the celebration of Nowruz, the Persian New Year, is shopping for new clothes. Spring is just around the corner, and it's time for new beginnings. And one of those new beginnings is expanding one's wardrobe. My dear friend Atifi, who lives in Tehran, excitedly left her home one day to go shopping at a local clothing store. While browsing around in the clothing store, she noticed Iranian security forces confronting the store owner. Later on, she discovered that the security forces had found that the store owner was in violation of the Islamic dress code. She had failed to put hijabs on all of the store mannequins and had to do so immediately or be arrested. It is Islamic law for all women to wear a veil when they go out publicly. If they fail to comply, they can be fined and arrested and lashed. But wait a minute. Help me out, please. Is there not a distinction between human beings and mannequins? What is a mannequin? A mannequin is a lifeless form of plastic representing a human being that is used to display the latest fashions in store windows. Oh, I get it now. The Islamic regime would prefer that all Iranians be just like mannequins. Mannequins don't speak or talk back or protest or whine or complain. These lifeless plastic forms wear whatever you put on them without a complaint and stand in a window all day. It seems that image is everything. According to Iranian law, Iranians are supposed to obey without complaint and wear whatever they are told, just like the mannequins in the store window. The sad reality to this image is everything scenario is that it reduces real human beings to lifeless forms without heart and souls. Human beings cannot exist under these conditions. They quickly lose all self-worth and self-esteem, and that's exactly what false religion does. It robs people of all meaning and purpose in life and reduces them to little more than puppets on a string. God didn't create us as lifeless forms or puppets on a string. He created us with great value and gave us a heart to discover the beauty of life that surrounds us. He breathed into our souls love, purpose, and creativity to shine like the brilliant colors of the rainbow and make a difference in a world of suffering and pain. Our lives won't shine very brightly if we are reduced to the morbid and depressing existence of mannequins in a store window. But image is everything, right? I think that sums it up quite perfectly. What the Islamic religion does to human beings is reduces them to lifeless forms of plastic. In my new book, Broken Yet Beautiful, I outline how Jesus treated women. Jesus was on a mission of giving hope to the hopeless. And in his hometown of Nazareth, he announced his messiahship to a hostile crowd that wanted to throw him down from a cliff. Before that, he had entered the synagogue and opened the scroll of Isaiah and began reading at chapter 61. All eyes were intently focused upon him as he opened his mouth to teach. "The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is upon me, for the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to comfort the brokenhearted and to proclaim that the captives will be released and the prisoners will be freed. He has sent me to tell those who mourn that the time of the Lord's favor has come." When Jesus finished and closed the scroll, he proclaimed, "Today, this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." The entire ministry of Jesus had been beautifully predicted in the powerful prophecy of Isaiah 61. He had come to proclaim good news to the poor in spirit, to heal the hearts that were broken by sin, and to set free the captives, free from their chains of sorrow and despair. This was indeed good news for the afflicted, the oppressed, and spiritually broken. There is a subtle but powerful little verse tucked into the fourth chapter of the Gospel of John that describes the spirit-driven mission of Jesus into forbidden territory. John chapter 4, verses 3 through 4. "He left Judea and departed again for Galilee, and he had to pass through Samaria." And he had to pass through Samaria. This is very important to understand. Jesus deliberately chose this route. He was a man on a mission to break down the hostile and divisive walls of racism that had existed for centuries between the Jews and the Samaritans. The Samaritans were despised and hated by the Jewish people. During the Babylonian captivity, when pagans had entered the land and mingled with the Jews, the result was a deadly mixed race. The Hebrews of the northern kingdom and the Assyrian settlers had intermarried, poisoning the pure race during the captivity in 722 BC. The worship of Yahweh had been corrupted by heathen practices and creating a major rift between the Jews and Samaritans. The Samaritans had offered to rebuild the temple at that time and were refused by the Jewish people. So as a result, that is, the Samaritans built their own temple on Mount Gerizim in protest. The Jewish people were known to say, quote, "May I never set my eyes on a Samaritan." However, Jesus had deliberately chosen the route that took him through Samaria so that he could break down the divisive barriers of racism and bring hope and healing to the hardened hearts that had been corrupted by sin for so many centuries. Weary from his journey, Jesus decided to relax, sitting next to Jacob's well, located in the Samaritan town of Sychar. Just as Jesus had sat down, a young Samaritan woman arrived with her bucket to draw water from the well. This woman specifically chose the same time every day to draw water from the well, knowing that she would be alone. Her reputation among the other village women had been tarnished because she was living with a man out of wedlock. In order to avoid the stigma of confrontation, the Samaritan woman secretly came alone. However, today she was not alone. As soon as the woman arrived at the well, Jesus startled her with an unusual request. give me a drink. The fact that Jesus was talking to a woman, not just any woman, but a woman from the despised and half-breed Jewish race, was shocking to her. Quote, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." Jesus, in talking to the Samaritan woman, broke down two barriers, one steeped in bigotry and the other in gender discrimination. When the Pharisees saw a woman approaching, they would close their eyes, and as a result were always constantly running into things. Thus they were nicknamed bleeding and bruised Pharisees. However, as we have seen so far, Jesus deliberately chose to go against the accepted racial norms of the day and broke with the accepted precepts of gender abuse. Jesus had traveled a long distance to keep a divine appointment with a woman who had been shunned by her female peers and ostracized by the Jewish race. If you knew the gift of God and who it is saying to you, "Give me a drink," you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water. Jesus reaches out in compassion to this shunned woman and invites her to drink of the water that will go beyond just quenching her thirst, but instead will fill her soul with refreshment and healing. Yet this woman does not yet grasp what Jesus is exactly saying. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? Jesus immediately corrects her perception and gently guides her into the spiritual truth that he is offering her. Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up until eternal life. The words of Jesus had penetrated the anxious soul of this woman and gave her a craving for what he was offering. "Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to drink water." Before Jesus graciously gives her the living water, she must first be gently prodded by the convicting grace of a holy God who knows everything about us. Jesus, in respect and politeness, points out the prevailing sin in her life that she needs to recognize before experiencing the refreshing taste of living water. Jesus said to her, "Go call your husband and come here." The woman answered in shame, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You are right in saying I have no husband, for you have had five husbands, and the one you have now is not your husband. What you have said is true." The Samaritan woman is astonished and recognizes Jesus as a prophet. However, she skillfully tries to avoid her sin by turning the conversation toward the subject of correct worship. The woman points out that she knows that when the Messiah comes, he will reveal all things to them. Jesus looks her intently in the eyes and proclaims, "I who speak to you am he." Dropping her water jar in shock and astonishment, the Samaritan woman rushes back into town, announcing in jubilation that she has found the Messiah. As a result, many believed her testimony. This is a beautiful and profound story of God's grace toward women. The Samaritan woman was one of the first persons that Jesus revealed his messianic identity to. She had come to the well on an ordinary day and left transformed by the true living water that had cleansed her from all of her guilt and shame. She also became a passionate evangelist, commissioned by the Son of God to take the message of living water to her village. The first evangelist was a woman who had the reputation of being a harlot and now was heralded as a beautiful bearer of good news. Christian author and apologist Ravi Zachariah has a powerful commentary on this beautiful story in John's Gospel. The Samaritan woman grasped what he had said with fervor that came from an awareness of her real need. The transaction was fascinating. She had come with a bucket. He sent her back with a spring of living water. She had come as a reject. He sent her back being accepted by God himself. She came wounded. He sent her back whole. She came laden with questions. He sent her back as a source of answers. She came living a life of quiet desperation. She ran back overflowing with hope. The disciples missed it all. It was lunchtime for them. This is the reason why many Muslim women leave Islam when they read about the compassion, hope, and healing that Jesus gives women. And when you hear today of all of the oppression, all of the violence, all of the discrimination against women in the stories I've shared with you, and then you realize they're being treated like mannequins in a store window, if you will, and then you see and hear the refreshing, beautiful, good news of Jesus and how he offers living water to you, you don't have to go away in shame and guilt today. You can be like the Samaritan woman, cleansed, refreshed, and given a new beginning by the Son of God. And so today, I've had the opportunity to share with you from my new book, Broken Yet Beautiful, the message of hope that is found in Christ. Iranians are embracing that hope. Today, you can have that same hope, that cleansing from guilt and shame, when you find your hope in healing in Jesus. This is how Jesus treats women. Unlike Muhammad and any other so-called prophet, he treats women with dignity and respect and brings hope and healing and forgiveness to their guilt and shame. Today, if your heart is yearning for this living water and you're thirsting for this living water, reach out to Jesus. He will give you this living water. Who you say I am, God says, I am chosen, not forsaken. I am who you say I am. I want to thank you so much today for joining me on this special broadcast, The Cross in the Desert, and I hope that you have that living water in your life. God bless you. I will see you again next Monday on The Cross in the Desert.
Welcome me. I was lost, but he brought me.